2 minutes late. Gotta love the traffic. Not really. Kings is here. No Nick yet. Gage walked in. Chris is here. Eli. Alright. So, quick exam update. The person who didn't take it contacted me. I set up a time for them to make up the exam, and then they never got back to me. So, I'm hoping to get it wrinkled out today. So that way I can just, because the way Engage, no, Blackboard works is I have to get every single thing graded before it opens it up. So, I apologize. The one person kind of knows that the class is frustrated with that individual, so hopefully that will motivate him to get it done. All right, so that is that. I also did receive one extra credit assignment. I read it real briefly today. I'm going to go back over it again in real detail, but it was very good. It was exactly what I was looking for, so, yeah.
I might be wrong. I was just...
Yes. Well, I was going to say you are wrong. Well, if you give me that opportunity, it's a 50-50, so.
But... It was either on Hulu or Disney Plus, something like that.
Yes.
I think it's on
Hulu.
Okay.
You're right. I did see it on Hulu.
Okay.
Well, and I think it's the speech.
Oh.
Trump's speech. Yeah, because it was aired on ABC. And yes, it's on Hulu. And I think it's there only for like a week left or something like that. So if you have Hulu, you can watch it.
Can I get to tomorrow for that?
Yeah, I didn't put a deadline on it.
Okay.
So yes, I would just mention that I got one in, and what it was exactly what I wanted. 5 issues were covered, and just gave me some thoughts about a paragraph on each one.
Okay.
It was really good, and it was a little, well, I kind of agree with it, but I kind of don't, and I appreciated that. So, you know, at the end of the day, and this is something you probably don't hear often, but I mean it, truly. I don't expect us to agree on anything, and that's fine. But you should never be afraid to share your opinion. And that's what I'm looking for. So don't ever give me something thinking, oh, I want the professor to like it. I want the professor to agree. I've been doing this way too long, and I'm an adult. And I have too much respect for all my students. I know there are some teachers and professors you'll come across where you have to agree with them or you'll be punished. I'm not one of those. That's not me. I'm a big boy. I'm confident in my knowledge, I'm confident in my analysis, I'm confident in my opinions. But I'm always willing to listen to different opinions. So that's what I'm hoping to get. All right, so I talked about that, I talked about the exam, talked about the extra credit. Okay, good. All right, any questions about what we were covering last class? Politics through history. What should our government do? What should be the ultimate level of power? Should the states be the primary source of power over our lives, or should it be the national government? For 250 years, there has been that clash back and forth, and it's still going on today. Last class, we talked about interposition, we talked about nullification, we talked about secession. Well, if you're paying attention to the news, what are all the Democrat mayors doing?
Disregarding the federal government.
Essentially, what they're trying to do is they're trying to use interposition. They're trying to get a coalition of the Democrat mayors to work together to stop the federal government from enforcing federal immigration law. It's still happening today. So don't think, just because we talked about something that happened in the 1780s, 1790s, 1800s, that it's gone. No, it's still present. And again, when I talked about secession, there is an active movement for half of Oregon, I believe, to secede and join Idaho. That could actually happen in your lifetimes. So all of these ideas are still present. Whether you are happen to be aware of them or not. But if you do a deep dive, it's amazing. History always repeats itself.
What's the argument for that?
In Oregon, there's like 5 Democrat dominant counties that controls the 30 counties, most of which are Republicans, because they're more urban. and the Republican-leaning counties are sick and tired of all of the Democrat laws and regulations, because most of them are farmers. Yeah. So they want to secede and go with a farming state, because they think their rights will be better protected.
I have a couple questions about the Congress speech.
Yeah?
One of the things he said, or two of them, that I found interesting, but in my mind, like, I don't understand the point of why he did it, made it such a big deal. He said that he signed something officially changing the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America.
America.
What's the point of that? What did that do?
Symbolic.
That's it?
Yeah.
Okay. Another one.
So there is always a sense of nationalism and patriotism. And one of the things that Trump has focused on is the fact that many people in our country have lost that.
Patriotism?
So, yeah. So this is just a way to get some people, you know, to be able to pound their chest. Well, like, we're America.
Okay.
But if you also look at it in terms of mileage, there actually is more American miles that abut the Gulf than Mexican miles. Mm. And it hasn't always been the Gulf of Mexico. It's had many names through the ages.
And we've half built the thing, so.
Yeah.
Another thing I thought, I don't know what else is going to play into effect, but he said they signed a bill or whatever it was, saying that there are only two genders, a man and a woman.
Executive order.
So now, what's that going to do to the whole LGBTQ crew? Like, does that change anything?
No, what it's going to be is how the federal government does its business. So instead of getting a federal government application where there's 98 different boxes for different genders, there's only going to be two. So anytime the president issues an executive order, it's the way the federal government does its work.
Okay.
That's it. So if the states want to recognize 98 different genders or whatever, and I'm not trying to be rude, but I know it's more than three or four. There's like 70, 80. I've just lost track. It's not something that I have my ears to the ground on, because I kind of believe in biology, but I'm old-fashioned that way. But there are states like Massachusetts. It might be 78, it might be 85, I don't remember. But that's a state decision. So if the people of a state want that, then that's what they're going to elect, and that's what they should be entitled to.
Even though it was a federal executive order?
Only the federal government. All executive orders can do is that the president can tell the executive government how to do the executive government.
Okay.
How the laws are executed.
Okay.
But it's not a law. Now, if Congress passed the law, went through the legislative process, and he signed it, then it could be enforced all the way down to the local level.
Okay. I got you.
But if you're paying attention to what he's doing, he's saying that if anyone goes against the orders, he's going to cut federal funding.
I did see that, yeah.
That's been a tool that the federal government has used for decades. And we're going to actually talk about it in federalism. So where they can't force the states to comply, they can kind of influence them.
Okay.
And that's perfectly legal. But that's politics. That's really hard-knuckle politics. Mm. Answer your questions?
Yeah, I thought it was funny how in the first 30 seconds of the video, somebody got thrown out.
Yeah.
It's great.
I don't think that's ever happened before.
I don't think the sergeant of arms has ever been called to do anything.
Yeah. No. I thought I heard that never in the history of presidential appearances before joint sessions of Congress has anyone ever had to been removed, a member of Congress.
First thing.
Yeah. Well,
they were all mad at it, so you could hear, like, they weren't, a lot of Democrats, they even called them out.
Yeah. They wouldn't stand and clap for a child with brain cancer being awarded an honorary Secret Service badge.
That's crazy.
So,
guys.
So, my first memory, and we'll just say this and then we'll go on, because we do got a lot we got to get through. My first memory of a type of disruption beyond we're going to applaud or we're not going to applaud, because they play that game all the time, is it was when Obama was president. And he was talking about when he passed Obamacare, and he went through his rhetoric that, you know, you're not going to have to change your doctor, the average household will save, you know, $2,500, all proven to be lies, but someone in Congress actually yelled that out. you're lying. And they happen to be a Republican. So that was the first time that I, as an adult, remember that ever happening. Never read about it either.
Of course.
So the problem with politics, particularly partisan politics, is it's tit for tat. So if the Republican pushes a little bit, the Democrat's going to push, and they might go a little further, and then it's going to just be back and forth to what we had the other night. The point of ridiculousness.
Yeah.
You had the parents of Riley Gaines, whose daughter was murdered. You had another, a young girl who had brain damage because she was going against a trans man and got a volleyball spiked in her head.
Oh, yeah.
You had the kid that was fighting cancer, a young African-American. So does that mean the Democrats are racist too? You know, it's just bad taste.
Yeah.
So if you don't like what the president's saying, fine. You don't applaud, you don't stand up, you don't act like walruses. Because that's the other thing. If you notice the Republicans, no matter what he's saying, they were acting kind of like walruses. Yeah.
I almost counted how many times the two guys behind him stood up and started clapping.
Right.
Just got over 20.
But again, that's optics. Yeah. So look, our guy good, you know, the other guy bad. Compare that to when Pelosi was the Speaker of the House. The last time Trump gave a State of the Union, she ripped up his speech. So it's optics. That's the game. But there should be certain things of decency. So if you have the guests in there, no matter why they're there, you pay them respect because they're going through something. You may not agree with the politics behind it, but again, a kid fighting cancer, I mean.
Yeah, like, how does that make you guys look good?
Yeah, I don't know. But again, apparently, Hakeem Jeffries, who is the Democrat leader in the House, from what I'm hearing, he's been having behind-the-closed-door sessions with memberships, and he's screaming at them, basically saying, you're embarrassing us, you're going to hurt us, and they don't care. You know, some of the members of the House are just so far radical left that, you know, they can't go to the center. And by the way, last point, that was the brilliance of Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton got elected. He didn't talk about social issues. He started pushing left-wing social issues in his first term. He got slaughtered in the midterms of 94, and then he went back to the center. So the Doge, if I know you're doing that, Doge was first envisioned by Clinton. Al Gore was the head of the department, the vice president, and they laid off something like 380,000 federal employees. And they cut the government. So
literally history repeating itself.
It is.
So interesting.
But when Clinton did it, it was a bipartisan effort. The Republicans and the Democrats worked together and they passed a balanced budget, which was something the Americans wanted.
Okay.
How is it being perceived now? Oh, crazy Elon and the billionaires and all the other stuff, right?
Didn't we have like just $1 billion in debt back then?
Yeah, well,
it
no,
was not, it was not
nothing
much.
Like it is today. Yeah. All right, but that's politics. So again, have your opinions on all that stuff. I have no fault with that. But just understand that what you're seeing on TV is not always reality.
Absolutely.
It's a game.
Mainstream media is one of the most bunk things out there as far as accurate information.
Oh, they've already proven it, that they are propaganda. And
absolutely,
we'll talk about it when we get to the media, if we get to the media. There are videos where, like what they did with the senators. Did you see that clip on TikTok or on X?
No.
24 Democrat senators gave a speech in reaction to Trump's address, and it was verbatim, word for word, the exact same script.
Mm-hmm.
And someone spliced them all together. Well, there was a video that I saw a couple of years ago with the media outlets.
Oh, yeah.
Doing the same thing. Talking the same story, word for word, like they're reading off a script. Something like 100 different media outlets. So, yeah. So they don't tell you the truth, which is like I've told you before. If you're right-leaning, you're going to go to one source. You're going to go like a Fox News. If you're left-leaning, you're going to go to MSNBC. But remember, they're not telling you the truth.
What is NPR considered?
Left-wing. Far left.
Oh, that. Because they speak like raw truth in NPR.
No, not really. It's very biased.
Biased?
Very biased.
Is that Nancy Pelosi's side left?
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So, secession. that's where we left off, dealing with the issue of secession. We know that there were people alive at the time that talked about it. We know Jefferson and Madison talked about it. We know, fast forward a generation, War of 1812, it was raised again. And New England and New York almost seceded from the Union. But for the war coming to an end, we could have been our own country. You never know what would have happened. And then it came up again a generation later in a battle between the sovereign state of South Carolina and the then president, Andrew Jackson.
Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt you again. But War of 1812, why was that causing a rift between us and the rest of the country?
Because it was financially benefiting the central and the southern states. North was not getting anything. Because during the war, all of the trade that they had been engaged in with England was severed.
Right.
So they're like, why do we want to send our boys to die when we stand to gain nothing?
So the economies of the South and the more northern states were more compartmentalized? They didn't.
Completely.
Okay.
Completely. Regionalized. Yeah. 100%. All right. That takes us to 1860. In 1860, there was a consequential presidential election in which you had a candidate running not on national issues, but running on regional issues. That would be one, Abraham Lincoln. He was a Northern Republican. The Republican Party was a relative newcomer to the political stage. By 1860, many of the Whigs found their way into the Republican Party, but there still was a Whig candidate in that election. The Republican Party was founded as an abolitionist party. The goal of the Republican Party was to end slavery. But Lincoln himself was not necessarily an abolitionist. Lincoln, however, did run on the need for raising tariffs. Early in the election, he was questioned because the United States was hitting a recession, almost a depression, 1858, 1859. President James Buchanan was not calling for anything. So in order to stabilize the economy, the Republican majority suggested, why don't we increase tariffs? Back to the level of 1833. And that tariff of abominations. Lincoln was asked on the campaign trail, do you support this tariff? And he actually said yes. So in addition to running in an abolitionist party and supporting the tariffs, that ultimately is what caused 11 Southern states, started by South Carolina, to secede from the Union. They argued that the United States was no longer governing for the benefit of all, but was only governing for the interests of the Northern industrialists. They also, because it was a Republican, an abolitionist, was threatening the economies of what at the time was 14 states. Remember, there were 14 slave states in 1860. Three of them stayed in the Union. Maryland, Missouri, and Kentucky. They did not secede. So, you had this huge problem. But Lincoln was opposed to the idea of secession. Why? Well, he argued that the Constitution was a binding agreement, and that when the states came in, they did not have the legal ability to simply leave. So, Lincoln argued that only the national government has the power over all of the states, and that the national government cannot be stopped in its use of power by the states. So, the Venn diagram, the two circles, the two spheres, by the time Lincoln was a president, thanks to Marshall, believed in the inverted model, where the national government was completely above the states, that they were no longer co-equal partners, that the states could not check and balance the national government. Lincoln argued the states only had the authority to act only in state matters. That's it. Now, I don't mean to give you spoilers, but the South lost. Just in case you weren't aware, the Confederacy lost the Civil War. The Union won. So this war, in terms of politics, was a huge blow to the arguments that people had been making since Jefferson and Madison. And if you know what happened when the war came to a close, it was such a blow to states' rights that the Congress literally occupied the 11 Confederate states. They imposed what's called Reconstruction. Dominating Reconstruction was the radical extreme wing of the Republican Party, who literally were identified in their day as the Radical Republicans. They stripped all Southerners of their constitutional rights. They stripped the Southern states of their right to govern themselves. They called for the arrest and prosecution of former Confederate leaders. And they called for the full enfranchisement of a class of people now known as the freemen. Former chattel slaves. Now, real quick, not all blacks were slaves in the Confederacy. And in fact, if you go to states like Louisiana, some of the largest slave owners were actually blacks. But the blacks who were enslaved were not, under the state laws, treated as human beings. They were treated as property, because the states controlled citizenship. The states controlled property rights. That was originally, under the original vision, those were state rights issues. But with the radical Republicans in charge, they literally sent the United States Army into the South. They occupied the South, and they started imposing their will upon the South. Again, if you took U.S. history during this time period, you should have learned of something called the Freedmen's Bureau. That was the federal agency that was created to bring this forward. But here's where politics comes in, because obviously Reconstruction, part of my language, was a shit show.
it was done badly, and ultimately that's what gave rise to Jim Crow, on how it was done. But in order to answer the situation as it existed, and to ensure that it never occurred again, the radicals would change the Constitution. They would implement not one, not two, but three amendments to the U.S. Constitution that forever stripped away the means of the Southern states to exist as they had done before the Civil War. One quick side note. If you're familiar with the Supreme Court case Dred Scott v. Sanford, in an 8-1 decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said, once a slave, always a slave. If you're born into servitude, you stay in servitude if that's what the state law says. So how do you create federal jurisdiction so the federal government can impose its will in an area that it didn't have constitutional powers to do so? You change the Constitution. The first was the 13th Amendment. What did the 13th Amendment do?
End slavery?
Forever abolished all forms of servitude. Either it be life slavery or indentured servants. Under the 13th Amendment, no longer could somebody be owned by another person. And then at the bottom, I think it's Clause 4 of the 13th Amendment, it gave Congress the power to regulate. So, if there ever was a claim of somebody owning another, it wouldn't be a state crime. It would be a federal crime. So it would go to federal court. FYI. Why couldn't Lincoln have just ended slavery? Why did you have to fight the Civil War to do this? In the Fifth Amendment, all American citizens have due process of law in areas of life, liberty, and property. So our Fifth Amendment protected slavery until the 13th Amendment abolished it. All right, well, that's great. Now you have all of these freedmen. They're no longer owed. But can the state discriminate against them? Well, technically, yes. So to make sure that the states could not discriminate, they then passed the 14th Amendment. The second of the three Reconstruction Amendments, the 14th Amendment. What the 14th Amendment did was impose upon the states the same restrictions that the U.S. government had under the 5th. Under the 14th Amendment, no state could deprive persons of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. They put in a due process clause that the United States government can enforce on the states. And to make sure you couldn't treat people differently, they also imposed the Equal Protection Clause. So now this one state could not treat someone different than another state. So no state could deny people of due process, and no state could treat people different than how they're treated in any other state. So if someone in the North gets full rights, the Southern states have to do the same. and the federal government will enforce. Questions on the 13th or the 14th, because I got one more to do. The 15th Amendment, then. Which did what? What is one of the most fundamental rights that we have as American citizens? No. No. How do we put people into office? Oh, 15th Amendment. Because what if you were to try, as you were a state, to turn around and say, well, these freedmen were former slaves, and what do they know about civics? So let's deny them the enfranchisement. Well, under the 15th Amendment, nope. All men, regardless of race, ethnicity, religion, are allowed to vote. Sorry, it didn't apply to the ladies yet. We're not there. We're only in 1871, I think. Oh, and like the 13th and the 14th, there also is a clause in the 15th that makes it federal jurisdiction. So if a state dares attempt to discriminate against someone based on their race and deny them the right to vote, you file a claim in federal court. And the federal government can tell the states what to do. So what this does is it takes the essence of citizenship out of the state's hands. And now there's this concept that we know today called the United States citizenship. And it's determined and controlled by the federal government. Which again, going back to that point of nullification, means it's interesting when these cities are trying to prevent illegals from being deported. That's a direct violation of the rights inherent to Americans in the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. All right, questions? Well, as a result of Reconstruction, not only was the Venn diagram flipped, but now the federal government is put essentially in a foundation of concrete. It's never going to be co-equal with the states again. Because if the federal government has the power to control what rights you have and whether you can vote and whether you are a citizen or not, the states can no longer counter that. And this would give rise to a new form of federalism, which sometimes is referred to as dual federalism. Sometimes it's referred to as the layer cake, in which the federal government now is at the top. And the parameters of what not only the state can do, not only what the counties can do, not only what the towns can do, is completely controlled by the federal government. The federal government is like a nice layer of fondant, keeping the mold of the shape of the cake in check. And how do they do it? Well, the Supreme Court. Beginning in the 1860s, 1870s, 1880s, the Supreme Court more and more responded to disputes between the nation and the states by using its power of judicial review to basically impose the will of the nation on the states and even cities and counties and towns. But we're not going to do the cities and counties and towns in here. That's what I do when I do state and local government. But here's the thing. if you go back and you read many of the historically significant cases that came out during this time, you can see the court was having a hard time trying to figure out where exactly the dividing line is, because it was new. You know, they were in a realm where the federal government had not acted before. And essentially, they were creating precedent. The first time in the water, if you will. So the disputes were not always clean. Sorry, the decisions were not always clean, resulting in more disputes. That makes more sense. And sometime even the court wasn't unsure of itself, because it began dealing with matters that never existed before, such as the quantum leap in technology. For example, during this period, the Supreme Court had to deal with the way in which our economy was moving, with the railroads. Particularly after the Civil War, when the transcontinental railroads were being built. Railroads were originally private, or rather viewed as private entities. They were businesses. And because it is the states that license businesses, generally, the businesses were allowed to do business in a way that was good for business. But sometimes the businesses did things that hurt people and competition. So, for example, one of the things that the railroads used to do is they used to set their own rates. They determined what it would cost for you to ship your products on their railroads. And they also added extra charges for storage, for redirection. Well, the problem is where the businesses were motivated by profit, sometimes the charges were relatively excessive. Although, not to give the socialist argument, because I'm a capitalist, but of course the railroad companies were also motivated by that that risk factor. Because if you know anything about railroads when they were first developed, there were constantly railroad accidents, bridge failures, you know, and the high costs of making these lines. So the company was taking profit so that way it would remain profitable.
A lot of people died making those railroads.
Oh, God, yeah. God, yeah. So, in comes the state of Illinois in 1871. And they passed a law to try to cap the rates that railroads could charge in one of the major railroad hubs in our country, the city of Chicago. But they did this only for agricultural products. Because obviously, if you charge too much for agriculture, the market may begin to subside, and then you have lots of waste. So the state of Illinois was coming in basically to lower the rates just so the food could get out quicker. Well, one of the railroad lines, Ira V.E.Y. Munn, it was the Munn and Scott Railroad Company, they decided they were actually going to sue the state of Illinois, claiming that Illinois did not have the right to do this under the 14th Amendment. The Equal Protection Clause. No other state in the country passed a law to impose caps. It's unconstitutional. Well, ironically, case goes to federal court because it's a federal question, gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, and in 1877, in the case of Munn v. Illinois, the Supreme Court would actually rule in favor of the state, claiming that any private company can, in fact, be regulated in the public interest. So you have a government entity regulating private activity. No precedent in U.S. law. But what does the court do? Well, because our constitutional legal system is based on English common law, the court couldn't make a decision based on U.S. law, so they use a precedent that goes all the way back to the 1600s, in which the courts in England said, yes, they can. Private property, when it is devoted to public use, is subject to public regulation, the court said. Sort of makes sense of it, because the railroad was moving commodities that people were going to buy and consume, the government could regulate it. Well, let me tell you, this started a firestorm all across the country. This case talked about in the newspapers. How dare the Supreme Court do this? The Supreme Court has no right. You are interfering with business. And states don't have a right to interfere with business.
Was the railroads owned by the Rockefellers?
No.
Rothschilds?
There was many families that would be involved, but we're not there yet.
Okay.
We're only in the 1870s. So, we now empower the states, the federal government, judicial review. We're going to make the states be able to regulate private industry. Why? For the public good.
Was that only for the state of Illinois, or was it for every state?
Well, the moment one state can do it, what do you think all the other states started doing?
They start
doing the same thing. So now, it looks like the states are going to be in charge of railroad regulation. Why? Well, that was the decision at the time. But fast forward 10 years, and another railroad case gets before the Supreme Court. Wabash, St. Louis, and Pacific Railroad v. Illinois. This railroad company, going against the state of Illinois, once again, over shipping charges. Illinois, in maintaining their rates, interferes with the Wabash Company charging rates based on distances. Well, as it turns out, Wabash was giving deals to companies shipping from as far away as Kansas and Oklahoma, long distances. So they were getting discounted rates. But the company was charging higher rates for shipping that was done in the interior of Illinois. And the company's like, well, you're charging us, so we have to offset the costs. Whereas Kansas doesn't charge us these rates, so we can give them a better deal. Well, the case gets all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the court reverses its decision in Munn. Because a decade later, the Supreme Court decided no. The states shouldn't be regulating railroad activity. Because what railroad line is only interstate, or rather intrastate? All of them continue into other states.
And who has the authority to regulate interstate commerce? The federal government. Now, what explains this decision? Well, this was one of the first major railroad cases. The court was still trying to figure this out. It was new technology. But now we have a decade. Times have changed. And the court's decision changes as well. But here's the thing. This is great. You have the Commerce Clause. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3. That says it's the federal government that regulates interstate commerce, but there's no federal laws on the books. How is the federal government going to do it? Well, just as the states responded after Munn, Congress responds after Wabash. The following year, Congress acts quickly and gives itself the means to regulate railroad trade by passing the Interstate Commerce Act. This law created the Interstate Commerce Commission, which would be a government agency whose job was to regulate railroad activity. So, if there's a claim of unfair business practices, it's going to now be the federal government's job to investigate. But, the state still retained some ability to regulate railroads. So, the states have the power to set the speed limits on the railroads. The states also have the power to impose licensing requirements. So can a railroad company do business within the state? Well, the company still has to apply to the state. If they don't get the license to do business in that state, they can't do business in that state. So here we have federal government on top, states below. Questions? But the problem is that it's not always nice and neat. Some issues, like a lovely black forest cake, sometimes the delicious vanilla frosting and the cherries kind of ooze into the cake layers. And it becomes harder really to say, well, there's one layer and then there's another layer. So what you started seeing is as the federal government advanced with regulations, so did the states as well. But it also gave government in general a chance to grow. Sometimes for the good, sometimes not, depending upon your political perspective. For example, law enforcement. Historically speaking, law enforcement is a local and state issue. Most of the crimes that we hear about on the news, murder, rape, assault, larceny, vandalism, arson, those are all state crimes. So if you kill somebody, you stab them, run them over with your automobile, it will be a local police officer that comes and arrests you. You will go to a state court and you will have your trial. And if convicted by a jury of your peers, you will go to a state penitentiary. But
If the federal government is going to start in passing laws, if the government determines an activity to be illegal, that makes it a crime. The states can't enforce federal crimes. So how is the federal government, if they're making all of these new rules and regulations, how are they going to enforce their own laws? Well, what do? They decide to get creative and they make their own agency. In 1908, the Federal Bureau of Investigation was established.
That's how long the FBI has been around?
Yeah, it was just about to ask
that. Yeah.
That's wild.
And you know what prompted the creation of the FBI? The assassination of President William McKinley. Why? Well, again, they don't teach you details much in history, but in the turn of the century, there was a lot of anarchists and radicals in our country that were actually engaging in acts of terrorism. They were blowing things up. They killed a couple of judges. There was a big bomb that blew up on Wall Street. And they also killed the President of the United States.
Is this around the time when people would start carrying guns and stuff to Congress?
Yes. Because they never knew.
Yeah.
Never knew.
Old J. Edgar Hoover ended up consolidating quite a bit of power himself.
Okay. We're not talking the 1960s. We're only talking the 1908s. Yeah. But you're right. Yeah, you would. So, this agency would be created to look into those anarchist terrorist activities. Although, you know where they really started getting active? One of their first assignments? Crack down on prostitution.
Who was originally in charge?
He was a descendant of Napoleon, the first director. I think his name was actually Bonaparte. So, you pass laws. There's nothing in the Constitution that expressly says the federal government can make criminal laws. It's kind of implied. The Supreme Court says it's fine. So the government creates a new agency. And suddenly it walks in. So now, what happens if you have a situation of a federal crime in a state? Who responds?
Federal.
Well, did I tell you my story that I always share with my buddy who's a state cop?
Yeah.
He was a state cop, pulled someone over on Massachusetts Turnpike, gave him attitude, had pot in the vehicle, called in the feds.
Yeah.
The feds will always have primary jurisdiction if there's a federal matter at stake. If it's a purely state concern, it will be state or local jurisdictions that respond.
Question, right? But yep. If you got pulled over, not on the highway, but in the city, that wouldn't be a federal thing. It would be a state, right? You know what I mean? It only became federal because it was on a highway, which is in the state. So if he was... got the same charges down the street here instead of the highway. That's good.
Yeah, if the Worcester cop wanted to call him the FBI, yeah, it could become a federal matter.
Anything can be.
Yeah, anything could become a federal matter.
I don't understand that. That's like forcing it.
So do you want to know my advice to that person would be? As a lawyer, okay. Comply. Why did my buddy call in his buddy who was a fed? Because the kid was giving him attitude.
So just to be a dick, pretty much.
Yeah, the kid was acting like a dick. He's got a bigger dick.
Was he acting smart though?
Well,
was he acting like...
Yeah, he was just acting all tough and just like, oh, fuck you. You know, you can't do anything.
Yeah.
He's like, okay.
But usually it's a severity thing, right?
I mean, oh, yeah.
It's this petty thing that local guys will take
well,
care
well,
of.
Well, the local guys do have discretion.
Yeah.
They can determine how far they want to ramp it up. So the best way not to deal with the most deep consequences, comply. Yes, sir. No, sir. I'm sorry, sir. You'll never run into problems.
And then
guaranteed.
Yeah, that CEO get assassinated, and that became a federal matter immediately.
100%. All right. So...
The federal government interferes in railroads. Never been before, but the court allowed it. Federal government starts making laws, creates the FBI. By the way, the FBI, there was a couple of cases where the Supreme Court said FBI is constitutional, even though there's nothing in the Constitution that expressly says that. Remember, necessary, proper. Well, the federal government would also interfere with banking.
Banking was purely a state matter. As we covered, the Constitution doesn't expressly give the federal government the power not only to create a bank, but there's nothing in there that says the federal government can regulate banking, period. They can coin money, they can collect and spend, they can borrow. But there's nothing there in terms of banking. Now, the government had been active since the 1850s when it created the Secret Service. Does anyone know what the original job of the Secret Service was?
Counterfeit money.
Counterfeiting. But going after people who are making counterfeit money and regulate the banking industry, whole different arena altogether.
Didn't they end up going after the mob for a bit first, before that became the FBI's domain?
What?
The Untouchables? Weren't those traitors?
No, that was Prohibition. All right. So why did the federal government come in? Well, again, if you take American history and you got a good professor and you cover what was going on in the 1880s, 1890s, there were lots of crashes, market crashes, beyond, and proportionally it was worse than the Great Depression. Because when the crash happened and the market crashed, banks, where people put their life savings, simply ceased to be. And there was no protection. If the bank folds, you lose everything. So, 1907 comes around, and there's another Wall Street crash. By that time, the Americans were sick of it. So there was a lot of political pressure on Congress to do something about it, to ensure that regardless of what the economy is doing, whether it's going high or low, that banking is protected. They also wanted to have an elastic currency, because originally we were on the gold standard, which meant the valuation of the dollar was based on whatever the market rate was gold. And of course that could be manipulated. And it happened a couple of times in U.S. history. So, fast forward 1912. Democrat President Woodrow Wilson is elected, and he brings in a couple of socialist academics, Carter Glass and H. Parker Willis, and they start working on this mechanism, this scheme on how the federal government would regulate banking. And what they came up with was the Federal Reserve Act, which was passed in 1913. Now, there probably is a map in your book, but if it's not, you could Google it and you can find it real easy. What this law does is it takes the United States and divides it up into 12 regional banking districts. And in each district, there is one Federal Reserve Bank. The Federal Reserve Banks are owned by member banks, state banks, local banks. So they basically buy in through like a subscription. When this law passed, any interstate bank by law had to join. State banks had the option to join. as we're local. To join, the bank had to turn over 6% of its capital. So 6% of whatever it had in the vault, it had to give to the Federal Reserve Bank to create a pool. This pool would be used to stabilize all of the banks. So, when you go out and get a job, depending upon what industry you work in, sometimes some companies allow their employees to bank sick days. So basically, the employees have the options of giving up some of their own personal sick days into a pool, and God forbid something happens to any of them, that person can draw on that pool, like a reserve. Well, it's the same thing here. So with this pool of money that's gathered by the subscriptions, if a local bank starts going under, they can apply for help. And the Federal Reserve Bank can come in and prop them up. So that way all of their customers don't lose everything.
When interest goes up and down, is that what they're talking about?
No, not yet. Not yet. So, I'm just talking about solvency to keep the bank alive. The other benefit of joining the Federal Reserve is that instead of giving out local notes or gold coins, you can get one of these. Federal Reserve note. Yes.
What about the FDIC?
That came in the 1930s. I'm not there yet. I'm only in 1913. This is the other thing that the members got to get access to. This would be printed and distributed to all 12 reserve banks and then distributed to all of the state and local banks, creating a national currency. So you can get one of these out of a cash register in Tacoma. Then you could go to Chicago, then you could go to Pittsburgh, then you could go to Peoria, using this everywhere you went as currency, instead of what you used to have to do. You only could get paper from a local bank, which meant it was only accepted by that local bank. So you would have to go and get gold coins. So if you wanted to go from Massachusetts to Rhode Island, you may have to go to your bank with your Massachusetts money, take out some gold coins, which are U.S. coins, and use those coins if you go to Rhode Island. Now, you don't have to do that anymore.
So the Federal Reserve Act was a mandatory
rewriting of... It originally was optional, but by the 1920s, it was required. So now all banks in the United States are members of the Federal Reserve System. Now, what does that mean? Well, very simple. The Reserve Bank now sets the valuation of this. What is this worth? It's determined by the Fed. And how does the Fed determine this today? Interest rates. And how much money's in circulation. FYI, the last administration pumped so many of these into our economy that if you had $1 in 2020, in 2025, it is worth 25% less. Supply and demand. But who determines the value? Now the federal government. It's not the market. And who controls it all? Well, a quasi-government board known as the Federal Reserve Board. There are 7 members plus the Secretary of the Treasury. And these individuals basically make determinations on money policy. It creates a flexible, sound currency that you can get anywhere in the United States. But the value is controlled by the Fed. Questions? So that, I gave you three examples of where the federal government stepped into places where they had never been. And again, there are so many other issues, we just don't have time to talk about everything that the federal government controls now.
If you were to send like a dollar in 2020 is a dollar, right? But it lost 25% in 2025. So are you saying
a dollar's worth of goods in 2020 is now the equivalent of 75 cents.
So if I look at a dollar bill right now, it's really 75 cents?
Yes, and because of inflation, prices have gone up 40%.
That's what I figured.
So now not only is your dollar worth less, everything's more expensive, so that means the buying power has diminished even more. Of course you can see it. Go to McDonald's and you pay $5 for a cheeseburger. I mean, come on now. I remember when cheeseburgers were a quarter. All right, questions on that? All right, well, there would be other issues. And again, the federal government tried making a minimum wage. There would be other issues. And there was constant battles in the courts. There would be constant experimentation. But whenever the federal government got too far, particularly once former President Howard Taft became Chief Justice in the 1920s, the court began striking down, holding the federal government in check from going too far. But that ended in the 1930s. Beginning in what is known as the Progressive Era, the federal government continued to experiment, to push the limits on the bounds of federal power. You invent the radio, so you create the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. If you try broadcasting a signal and you don't have a federal license, the federal government will come and arrest you. The FCC also has the right to regulate anything that not only goes over the airwaves, but in this day and age, also everything that appears on the TV. So going back to that first day quiz, when I put boobs on the TV, or however I phrased it, it's the FCC that says no. You can have boobs on like HBO, because that's subscription, but you can't have boobs on Channel 5 at 6 o'clock in the afternoon. The FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. Read about what was going into foods at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, particularly in the Chicago meatpacking plants. There was a study that was done, and it was estimated that a higher percentage of non-food was in beef than actual beef. Well, if you have a bunch of hamburger and it falls on the floor, so that way it doesn't get slick, is covered in sawdust. So the meat falls on it, just pick it up, put it back on the conveyor belt. What about if a rat happens to fall in? Grind them up. Bones, anything. What happens if there's an accident when the worker gets his hand ripped off? Don't shut the line down. Plus, there was all those wacky miracle cures in drugs. You know what the base ingredient for Coca-Cola was?
Cocaine,
yeah, exactly.
I saw a thing. I was watching a video about, do you remember the murder case of Black Dahlia?
Somewhat.
She was like found like dead on the side of the road in L.A.
The name rings a bell. It's probably in there somewhere.
It's like an unsolved murder. Yeah. Like that. It's not like related to the story, but one of the suspects, if this was in like the 50s, so like one of the suspects, in order to like debunk whether he did it or not, they use truth-telling serum on him.
Oh, I believe it.
So like, but like that's not a thing. So like no one knows if that's...
Oh. Like, no, there is. They do have concoctions that can basically break your resistance to saying no.
It's anesthesia. I mean, you wake up from anesthesia, you're loopy, and you don't really have your inhibitions.
I mean, LSD, where do you think LSD came from? You know, that was an attempt to create super soldiers. You look at what the SS soldiers were used in World War II. The Nazis were crazy because they were all hopped up on amphetamines and other drugs.
Rock candy.
Yeah. All right, let me just explain each one of these and then we'll call it class. The federal government also created national parks. Nothing in the Constitution that says the federal government can come in and take lands and from the states and designate it as federal property. Well, Teddy Roosevelt. He was big in preservation. He was a conservationist. He wasn't an environmental Nazi. He didn't want to stop everything and go green, but rather he realized that if we use all our resources in 1908, what about the generation that's going to be around in 2108? So you have the federal government put it in like a reserve fund and slowly monitor its use. Keep those resources going. And of course, if businesses got too big, the government started going after them and breaking them up. Rockefeller, Standard Oil. There was one point when something like 90% of all oil products that were sold globally were sold by Rockefeller's Standard Oil. Well, the federal government decided that was a monopoly, so we had to break it up. And that's how Exxon, Mobil, and a whole bunch of other gas companies and oil companies were created. Although the funny thing is that when the Supreme Court did that to him, Rockefeller made more money because now he was the majority shareholder in all these different companies. So, what am I saying? More and more, there's a concern, politics. Well, let's see if the federal government can do something about it. And it creates more rules, more regulations, which of course drives expenses up. But how do you get the states to go along with it? Well, we'll deal with that on Wednesday. All right. No rush on those extra credit assignments, but obviously the quicker you get them in, the better. And with luck, you will see your exams today or tomorrow.